Okay, we're going to get started with the Understanding the FY09 Proposal Guidelines Clue-In Session hosted by EPA Region 7. As a reminder to everyone on the phone, please sign into the session by accessing the link provided in your confirmation email and then clicking on the Go to Seminar button on the left side menu. You'll be prompted to enter your first and last name, unless someone else registered, and it should be their first and last name. And also using your confirmation email, please access the PowerPoint presentation that we'll be going through today. And we'd like to encourage you to download the presentation and save it to your desktop to make sure there are any issues or delays associated with internet service. And we'd like to ask that you mute your phone during the presentation to eliminate any background noise. *6 mutes phones and #6 unmutes phones. And as a reminder, please don't put the call on hold in case you have any hold music or any static in the background. We'd like to ask that all of your questions be held to the end of the presentation. If you're streaming the presentation online, please feel free to submit your questions online as we go along, and I'll present them to the speakers on your behalf during the question and answer section that follows the presentation. We have 6 speakers from EPA Region 7 today. The speakers will remind you what slide number they're on so that you can easily follow along. Our speakers today from Region 7 are Stephanie Doolin, the RCRA Brownfields Coordinator, Alma Moreno-Lamb, the State Brownfields Coordinator for Missouri, Susan Klein, the Brownfields Regional Program Coordinator, Bob Richards with the Office of Regional Council, Jim Seiler, the Revolving Loan Fund Program Lead, and Brad Vann, the State Response Brownfields Coordinator for Kansas. And I'm going to turn it over to Brad Vann now to begin the presentation.
All right, thank you, Amy. You can hear me fine?
Yep, sounds good.
Good deal. We're going to start off slide number 3, if you will advance to that. The purpose of our webcast session today is to specifically discuss requirements for the FY09 Brownfields Grant Competition and to highlight the changes in the proposal guidelines for this year. There have been significant changes between last year and this year, so we thought it was important to host this event. Please note that EPA is also performing 2-day-long workshops, one in Omaha, Nebraska on September 25th and one here in the regional office in Kansas City, Kansas, on the 29th. These workshops will provide a greater detail and an opportunity for your direct interaction with our folks, the state folks, and also Brownfield Technical Assistance people, or TAB grantees in Pace State. So we certainly encourage you to attend one of those events because, again, they will cover this information that we're going to talk about in much more detail. We have also scheduled a follow-up webcast the morning of October 21st. Which will specifically be a Q&A opportunity should you have any last-minute threshold or competition-related questions. So at this time, if we will, go ahead and go to the next slide, slide number 4. And again, we're going to start off here. This just leads off the Brownfields mission. And again, EPA's Brownfields program was developed to assist communities with safely addressing environmentally challenged properties through assessment and, if needed, cleanup while developing partnerships and providing opportunities for meaningful community engagement, which ultimately leads to sustainable site reuse. Today we will be specifically discussing competitive site assessment and cleanup grants. Some general information and context we provided for other items such as job training, which are also competitive grants but are issued under a separate RFP and competition. Next slide, please, slide number 5. This is an excerpt of the Brownfields definition, and again, funding for EPA's Brownfields program is authorized by the 2002 Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act, I can even say that, a.k.a. Brownfields Law, this amended circular Superfund Law. And again, this is an excerpt from the basic definition that's provided, you can see on the slide, and I want you to really key in on several words that I've highlighted there, which are real property, for one. In addition to the definition, potentially allows real property allows for contaminants to be addressed, such as interior asbestos, lead paint, mold, or meth lab residues, something not possible under traditional Superfund projects and without some sort of potential or release of contaminants in the environment or exterior. This is a little bit how brownfields is a bit different. Also, what makes it different is that it not only doesn't have to be a presence, but there can be a potential presence, or just that stigma that's on that property that causes it to be an issue for the community. So, if you will, the next slide, please, slide number 6. And this slide just talks about eligible contaminants that are allowed under the brownfields program. And you can see here we have hazardous substances, petroleum contamination, which are your primary categories. And underneath that, there will be items such as asbestos, lead, paint, or eligible under hazardous substances. Controlled substances, such as you get from meth lab residues that contaminate properties. Mine-scarred lands are allowed. And, of course, other environmental contaminants. One thing to note, asbestos and lead paint are preferably addressed as part of a larger hazardous substance or petroleum assessment cleanup project. While allowable standalone projects, proposals must make a strong case for these contaminants because they're generally viewed as being a little bit lower risk in general nature. So the next slide, if you will, slide number 7. This slide, of course, goes over some of the benefits of the brownfields and revitalization program. And brownfields revitalization provides a wide range of benefits to your community, which include, and of course, are not limited to, the increases in your local tax base, new job growth, savings on development and maintenance of infrastructure. It also saves green space and native habitat destruction while preventing urban sprawl, and ultimately supports clean air, and which is, of course, caused by the reduction in travel distance for people. Next slide, if you will, slide number 8. And this slide talks about EPA's investment in the Brownfields grant. And these are our national numbers, and you can see that since 1995, EPA has nationally awarded nearly 2,000 Brownfield grants totaling nearly $600 million. And it's provided a significant number of property assessments, cleanups, and leverage more than $10 billion in brownfield cleanup and redevelopment funding, and also generated well over 47,000 jobs. So the impact from the brownfields program has been significant and been utilized very well by our community. Nationally this year, EPA anticipates awarding an estimated $81.3 million, or approximately 329 assessment cleanup-related grants. So there's a significant opportunity out there for communities to become engaged in the competitive process. Next slide, please, slide number 9. This is just kind of an example slide we threw out here. And again, it's an example of a successful cleanup recipient. And in this case, this recipient utilized a Brownfield Competitive Cleanup Grant from the FY08 competition here to clean up a former plating facility. And this led to an immediate redevelopment of an additional parking structure, or parking lot, I should say, for the local university sports complex, and will ultimately support the adjacent historical building next to it for beneficial reuse. So just a good example of actually what was a very fast cleanup grantee. In fact, it was less than, I think, a month or so.
3 months.
3 months, fairly quick. You do have actually 2 years or to proceed with one of those. But at any rate, we'll go to the next slide, slide number 10. And for those who are old hands at the Brownfields program, and you've probably seen this slide before. We did modify it slightly this year. But again, it provides the annual EPA Brownfields funding breakout for our program. And this breakdown of EPA's annual appropriation of the Brownfields program. And just note first that at the bottom you can see $50 million is set aside for our non-competitive portions for the development of state tribal response programs. And it's also used to perform what's called a targeted brownfield assessment, or TBAs, more commonly referred to. The remaining funds are allocated for the competitive grant process and to provide technical assistance to our grantees. Our focus today, of course, is on the first three, which are highlighted there in orange, the assessment, revolving loan fund, and the cleanup grant. And we're more commonly referred to those as ARC when you put them in that order, or ARC-type grant. Again, job training and targeted brownfield assistance from EPA and state and tribal grants will be touched on a little bit later in today's presentation, but not discussed in any great detail. EPA must also assure that 25% of all of our competitive funding that's awarded for site assessment and cleanup does indeed go to petroleum projects. So as you can see, there's a 25% set aside by statute. If you will then go to slide number 11, thank you, you'll see that, again, the Brownfields Competitive Agreement, as I had spoken before, we're going to discuss the assessment, the revolving loan fund for cleanups, and what's called a direct cleanup or cleanup grant. And again, commonly these are referred to as ARC grants. And again, for just for clarification, we'll discuss all three of these types. Authorized, and these are authorized under CERCLA Section 104K, for those who really like to know the legal side of it. But again, they're commonly called ARC grants, and historically they were also referred to as pilots, which is an older date, or an older term you may have heard. But again, these are competitive. Next slide, please. Slide number 12. All right. Again, and all this does is this just, again, emphasizes that this is a competitive part of the program. And it is very competitive. Applicants should be prepared to put in time and effort into constructing, a winning proposal. And just try to remember that about 2 out of every 5 proposals are selected for award that are put in. Because, you know, we have, like everybody else in government, we have limited number of funds and many folks trying to take advantage of it. So each year, the number of proposals received by EPA increases. I will note, however, that we have a very good success rate of if you are unsuccessful, let's say, this year, and you do, you just put in a tremendous amount of time on this proposal and it doesn't, for some reason, rank well, I encourage you and those that were involved in that proposal to sit in on a debrief afterwards, because we do provide debriefings post-selection to those who were unsuccessful. And we found that many of our unsuccessful candidates have then turned around and resubmitted the following year and actually been quite successful. So. Next slide, please, would be slide number 13. And again, this just sort of breaks out the kind of the results of the funding and how it's divvied up nationally and, of course, regionally. Of course, for those who may be from other areas and aren't aware, EPA Region 7 does indeed cover the states of Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and 9 federally recognized tribal nations. So that's when we say EPA Region 7, that's the area we're referring to. In the past, Region 7 generally has received about 6 to 8% of the national funding. In FY08, we actually did quite well and received nearly 7%. And just an example, last year in FY08, we had 49 submittals and 26 were successful. And granted, this is out of over 800 proposals that we received nationally. So you can see it is indeed quite competitive. But the good news is, again, we're somewhere between 6 to 8%. We had 7% last year. So if you can think of it in terms of capacity, we still have more room in the region to have more awards if we have good proposals to send forward for ranking. So that's an encouragement. There are also, one thing to note, there are also post-award requirements, and an example of this would be, for instance, last year we had 26 selected in communities to award, but out of those, 23 actually went forward. Well, actually 22 at first. We had one added back later, but we had 4 applicants that had cleanups. And under cleanup, there's a post-selection requirement that you must own the property by June 30th, 2008, which they failed to meet. So just making you aware that even though you're successfully ranked and EPA contacts you and says, oh, here's an opportunity to get the big check, there are still those post-selection / pre-award requirements that you have to meet. And again, they're not great in number, and then they're well spelled out. But you just have to kind of have those in mind when you're putting everything together. We'll go to the next slide, please, slide number 14. This just kind of gives your 2009 applicable timeline. And again, the RFP, or Request for Proposal, for the ARC grants went out on August 22nd. This proposal will close November 14th, or we will quit accepting proposals, I should say, on November 14th. And then a selection will be made sometime in the spring, usually around the month of April. Okay, one thing to note, there's an error on this slide where it says approximately 70 to 75 million. We did note this year that that number is going to be, that's a bad sign. Hopefully we can find our way back to slide 14.
Pressure's on, Amy.
Yep.
Actually, that's not Amy, that's us.
Looks like we're getting there. Hold on just a second, folks, and we'll get ourselves back here due to minor technical glitch to slide 14 soon enough. Okay, we are back. All right, again, that approximately 70 to 75 million. This year, they're estimating headquarters that will have 81.3 million available. And again, this has disappeared. I'll continue, and maybe we can straighten this out. So, at any rate, after the proposals, so cooperative agreements will be awarded by September 30th. And one thing to note that after proposal is selected, the formal grant application has to be submitted, which includes the standard federal forms, award plan that will need to be submitted and approved. Awards can take up to 90 days from the time of submission from the final application of your, or the time we receive your application package.
Try clicking into the left buffer.
Awards, again, will not be made if any post-selection criteria are not satisfied. For example, under cleanups, if you don't perform your community notification or you don't perform your property ownership, they will not be awarded. We're just trying to work out our little glitches here. Hold on just a second, folks.
Okay.
And maybe it might be better to flip to 15 and slide 14 being a problem. So that had kind of like a little flashy thing, and that might be what's causing our error.
Okay.
So we'll move on to slide 15 and get past the hopefully problematic one. And you can see here from slide 15, where we're going to go now is just kind of getting started. Say, that's why you're here today. Well, again, the fiscal year guidelines for the ARC grant are available at the National EPA link provided, or you can also find them through www.grants.gov. Guidelines this year are segregated by type, so be sure to use the correct set of guidelines for either assessment, revolving loan fund, or cleanup. So we don't want you trying to submit a proposal based for assessments off cleanup guidance, because there are significant differences. Read the guidelines thoroughly and be sure to follow all the requirements for proposal submittal. For example, this year, responses to all ranking criteria must first cite the criterion number and title in their proposal before they do their text description. This is different from last year. So there are some subtle changes, and there are some very significant changes. So again, be sure to read the guidelines thoroughly. Also, be sure to engage your state partners, and there are also EPA-provided resources such as the TAB, or the Technical Assistance Brownfield folks out of K-State, that serve our region, and there's a TAB that will serve your region if you're listening in from someplace else. And they also have tools out there that they've created, such as TAB-EZ, that will help assist you with writing or reviewing your proposals prior to submission. So again, they highlight there, this event is not a substitute for reading the guidelines closely, so please do so, because we often see very minor, very significant errors that were clearly spelled out in the guidelines every year, and we hate to see somebody get bounced out for something like leaving off a state letter. So, okay, next slide, please. Slide number 16. There we go. It's working. It's just working too well now. Okay. All right. Again, there have been significant changes to the assessment grants, and that's where we're going to start today. We're going to start with the assessment grants, but again, between last year and this year, there's been significant changes. EPA is still offering assessment grants to eligible entities to inventory, assess, characterize, and conduct cleanup planning with community involvement at brownfield sites. And these grants are still offered for community-wide and site-specific use at up to $200,000 per proposal for either hazardous substances or petroleum. So that hasn't changed. But as for the changes, and it gets a little unique here, so bear with me and I'll try to walk you through this. And if you seem a bit confused at first, we've got a graphic that's going to maybe help me recover what I'm going to discuss, so we're not totally lost, like I can often be. So, at any rate, as for the changes, I'll start with the community-wide proposals. And you can see at the bottom it says community-wide, and I think what you need to key in here is eligible entities or communities can apply for up to $200,000 for hazardous substances.
No, back one.
We lose again?
Oops. Two now.
What?
Yeah, we... There
we go.
We're on the right side now. Number 16.
Bill on 16, good. Okay, again, eligible entities can now apply for up to $200,000 for hazardous substances and $200,000 for petroleum contaminants in separate proposals, and here's the difference. That's the same as last year, but here's the difference. If you plan to address different target areas. However, if you plan to address the same target area with two proposals, this year you can simply submit one proposal or bundle it together for $400,000, separating $200,000. Is it moving again?
Yeah, it's moving again. Let's see if I can get it.
Trying to work out some new technology. I apologize, folks, and hopefully we can...
If anyone else is having problems with the slides, I'd encourage you to download the presentation directly from the CLUIN website.
Do that at Lord Manual.
Okay, we are on 17, right?
We are on slide 16.
Okay, we're on 16. Let me
get
back to there.
One slide.
Okay. Let's see if I can get it on there.
No. And it moved by itself.
Yeah, it's doing its own thing.
Give us just a moment, folks, and we're going to try to shift from this hand-controlled device to a manual operation to see if we can, and just
set
that
work.
Down, because it's going to trigger stuff possibly while he's going.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
You take control.
So go to slide, you can just click slide 16 there on the left-hand margin, Devin, and it will go straight.
Yeah, it'll go straight.
Okay. Now we'll see if we can stay steady here. We'll work the kinks out during my part, and everything else will be fine. All right, now, again, eligible entities can apply up to $200,000 for hazardous substance and $200,000 for petroleum contaminants in separate proposals if you plan to address different target areas. However, again, if you want to address the same target area, this year you can simply provide one proposal or bundle that for up to $400,000, again, $200,000 maximum for each hazardous and petroleum. You're just bundling into one proposal. And then all of it's required simply is that you be sure to break out the appropriate information under such categories as budget or project description within your narrative. The second thing to discuss on this slide is that, and that's the little new flashy there at the bottom, is that three or more eligible entities can now form a coalition. We used to allow coalitions, and we still do under revolving loan funds. But this is what's new, is now they can apply for a community-wide assessment for up to $1 million. So that's pretty significant. And such coalitions will allow small and rural communities that do not have necessary resources or opportunities to partner with others. This kind of gives them a chance to get together with larger entities and participate in the Brownfields program, which is really part of the conception of this idea. Again, all coalition applicants cannot, however, apply for other assessment funding in the same year. So if you're part of a coalition, you can't then apply for another community-wide or a site-specific assessment grant this year. So again, this is a little confusing, and I'll reiterate this here in a few moments. If we can, please advance to slide 17. All right, assessment grant program. Again, this is the site-specific component. And like last year, site-specific assessment grants are still allowed to apply for up to $200,000 for either petroleum or hazardous substances. It may be allowed a waiver for up to $350,000, but again, these are reviewed by EPA on a case-by-case basis and should be a hardship classification waiver. These types of assessments must still go through also the site eligibility and property ownership determination during the threshold or prior to national ranking. So you obviously, that your proposal will not go forward if that site is not an eligible brownfield site. If you have any questions about these type of grants or have a site eligibility question, be sure to call us so that we can provide you that information. As for the changes this year, the applicants can apply for no more than one site-specific assessment grant. But it can be in addition to either two separate community-wide proposals for different target areas or one bundled community-wide proposal for the same target area. Again, not with a coalition. So if we will, let's go ahead and go to the next slide. And Susan put together this graphic for us, which I think helps explain much of what I went through. And I know it looks perhaps a little jarring at first, but it does make quite good sense. Again, so if you will, you look in the upper left-hand corner, You can see here we're going to start off with if an eligible entity wants to submit a proposal, this is, again, with regard to community-wide and site-specific. Ignore the coalition. But if you want to submit one proposal for a community-wide, there's kind of a path you can take here on the community-wide. Because you can have, on the left-hand side, you can see you can have one proposal or two proposals going in for community-wide, plus, if you look below the plus, you can have one proposal also going at the same time for a site-specific assessment. Doesn't mean you have to have it, but you can have it. So in other words, for assessment grants, if you're not applying under a coalition, you could apply for realistically either two or three proposals. And when I say two or three, if you look at the top part again, remember the community-wide, if you're going after the same target area, which is number one there, or path one, you can submit one proposal for a maximum of $400,000 to address both hazardous substances and petroleum, again, up to $200,000 each maximum for each substance within the same target area. So again, just think of it as a bundled one application. Or down below, number two, you can submit two separate community-wide proposals for different target areas. So if you're working on the west side of town for petroleum and you're working on the east side of town for hazardous substances, that would be your path. If you're dealing with the same side of the community, it doesn't matter, then path number one would be your path. And again, you can, if you have a site-specific, you can also do one site-specific. So I know it may be a little confusing, but this will help once you go back to it and reference it. And again, if you have any questions about this, these are new, feel free to call us. We can clarify. So if we will, let's go to slide number 19. Very cool, it went there. All right. again, this is the assessment coalition part, which is, again, brand new for assessment grants. We have done them in the past for RLF and still do. This means that three or more eligible entities can now apply for up to $500,000 for hazardous substances and $500,000 for petroleum contaminants, or a maximum of $1 million for a community-wide assessment grant. Coalition members must submit their proposals identifying one of their participants as the grant recipient. So in other words, you've got to have a main primary or point of contact who's going to manage the grant. Coalition members may not have the same jurisdiction, for example, different departments in the same county, unless they are separate legal entities, for example, a city and their redevelopment agency. Coalitions cannot apply, as we said before, for site-specific or other community-wide, and under their coalition, they must assess a minimum of five sites. This is not an intention to give people money to go after bigger sites for, say, a site-specific. So again, you must have five sites or more. And then there are post-ranking and a pre-award requirement, which is that a memorandum of agreement, or MOA, must be in place prior to the grant's award. This documents the coalition's distributions of funds, site selection process, and your mechanisms for implementing the assessment work. So that's it for assessment. Let's move on to page number 20. And again, this is just a placeholder. This is an example of a brownfields assessment success. That again, here was a property that was assessed under a community-wide grant, just one of many, which set the stage for its redevelopment from an illegal garage into a viable community library. Next slide, please, which would be slide number 21. And again, I'll kind of go a little slow here because these do have graphics. Some people's pages may take longer to load than others. But again, this is another success story. And again, it's an example of a site-specific assessment grant. And here is a case in which the assessment grant was utilized to investigate remnants of a late 1800s or early 1900 lead zinc smelter site. And that grant is, of course, active and currently in progress of wrapping up its phase two. So it's gone quite well. Next slide, slide number 22. Here we talk about the revolving loan fund program. And again, revolving loan fund grants, or RLFs, can be used to carry out can be used by an eligible entity to issue loans or subgrants to carry out brownfield cleanups. RLFs can be provided with funding up to $1 million per applicant per competition year. So you only get one shot at these every year. Coalitions naturally may apply for this. A minimum of 60% of the funding must be utilized for loans, which can be low or even no interest loans, but they must be utilized for loans. A maximum of 40% can be utilized for subgrants. 20% cost share is required with an RLF, and nonprofits are not eligible to administer this kind of cleanup. So they're not eligible to receive an RLF. Next slide, be slide number 23. Here we talk about the cleanup grants or the direct cleanups, and these are for cleanup activities specifically, not assessment, and they are site specific. The maximum funding is up to $200,000 per property at either hazardous substance or petroleum site, and up to three proposals may be submitted by each entity per competition year. There's no bundling. Again, these are site specific. All proposals must be submitted separately. On sites where hazardous substance and petroleum contaminants are commingled, the proposal must clearly state which is the predominant contaminant and be identified as such. So, for example, if you have site A and you have approximately 60% petroleum contamination and 40% hazardous substances, the proposal should be submitted as a petroleum cleanup. And then in the proposal itself, however, you would want to identify those other contaminants in your project description. Again, there is a cost share with cleanup grants, which is 20%, but applicants can provide for a hardship waiver. And I want to note this. We always put this in there, and I know people think, well, if I put in for a hardship waiver, even though we really, really need it, I'll probably get docked in points. Well, that's not the case. You know, putting in for a hardship waiver doesn't control your ranking. As long as you just have to document your hardship and show that need. So again, if you are a small community, you have limited resources, or an eligible entity, I should say, and you have limited resources, don't be afraid to submit for a hardship waiver. Everyone's, of course, will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis. It's not guaranteed, though. Okay, new this year, community notification is required before the proposal is submitted to EPA. In the past, we'd had community notification requirements on all three ARC types. This year is required for the cleanup alone before you submit the proposal. And this is, in other words, this is part of your threshold or pre-ranking requirements, which will be discussed at later detail in this fluid session. I just wanted to highlight that now. Again, an item not on this slide, which is a threshold requirement, is the application or the applicant must submit a proposal that states clearly that a Phase 2 environmental site assessment has been completed or a work plan received prior to the proposal submittal as well. So these are some threshold requirements that you will have to meet. Post-selection pre-award requirements, the applicant must own the property, as I stated earlier, for cleanup by June 30th, 2009. And there are no exceptions in this. Headquarters may, that is the line. So be sure to keep that in mind for those of you who I know who are trying to plan those purchase acquisitions accordingly with the award date. Again, that award date, if you are selected for award, I should say, if you successfully rank, will be around April. That gives you until June of that year to get your acquisition nailed down. So don't miss that. Next slide, slide number 24. Again, this was just a placeholder to show a successful example of a cleanup. And this was from the 05 year competition. The grantee used $200,000 in cleanup funds to remediate an early circa 1900 power station, which ultimately leveraged additional resources, saved a historic structure, and was redeveloped into an interactive learning center for at-risk children. Contaminants addressed during the cleanup included lead-based paint, asbestos, and petroleum products. So this money makes a difference. This entire project was well up in the neighborhood of $10 million, but the $200,000 that went into it for the cleanup was a vital point of leveraging for this grantee. So it does make a difference. Slide number 25. And this is just a slide that, again, to discuss community notification prior to submission of cleanup proposals. Again, this is threshold for cleanup, and this is a nice picture of that kind of brings home, you need to remember to target and engage your community in a manner that allows for effective and direct feedback and ultimately comment response. And this is just an example of a successful grantee performing some community outreach within their targeted community. So again, be sure to target that the notification that you provide the community, again, in a meaningful manner. So next slide, slide number 26. And again, this just summarizes everything we have discussed with regard to the assessment, the cleanup, revolving loan fund, and job training is also out there. So these are our competitive grants. It provides you with the information that you need to know with regards to how many you apply for, how much, who is eligible, the funding, and the kind of activities that you can perform with these. And again, this was a placeholder we put out there for your information should you need to refer to it later. But we've already covered the critical elements. So if you will, next slide, slide number 27. And again, this is here are some links to our regional webpage should you have more interest, such as this year's job training grant competition, or wish to know more about the non-competitive targeted brownfield assessment program. So those links are out there. And our webpage, it was literally just recently updated a week ago. So our contacts are on that webpage for every program. And if you need to contact, say, Ina Square for job training or Susan as the program coordinator, you will find our direct contact numbers on there in our emails. So next slide, please, slide number 28. Okay, that concludes my portion. At this time, I will now turn it over to Mr. Bob Richards from our Office of Regional Council, who will be discussing threshold and pre-ranking criteria.
Thank you, Brad. I'm Bob Richards. I'm out of the Office of Regional Council, and I assist the Brownfields program on one of the more critical elements of threshold criteria, and so that's why I have this particular section to cover. Let me see. Next slide, please. We're on number 29, and Amy, are we still online? Are we getting contact or broadcasting as we should be? This is just quality chat.
Yeah, everything's my end.
Okay, great. If we get to you, we assume we're getting to everyone. I'm on number 29 here, and the threshold criteria are developed for these three types of grants in order to meet certain statutory requirements, and we have some policy requirements, but also the work that you put in meeting these threshold criteria also relate to the potential success of the grant, in particular on the cleanup components because of the requirement that you have certain site assessment work completed as part of your application. The responses to the threshold criteria undergo a regional review. It is a pass or fail criteria. There are no points. The ranking criteria, which will be discussed later, do have point values. But failure to pass means that the proposal will not be forwarded to the national competition. We can assist you in particular on the site eligibility, and the states are also going to be a resource for additional preparation assistance for these criteria. Next slide, please. And we're on number 30. This lists all of the criteria. Looks like we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 criteria, and we'll be discussing these later in my presentation here. The parentheses after each line there is, of course, our standard abbreviations here for assessment, revolving loan fund, or cleanup grants. The description of jurisdiction is limited to the RLF, for instance, and that just helps you read it. But in short, we make sure that the applicant's eligible, that the state's on board, that the property qualifies, that you have the requisite authorities, and we know where you're going to be using the funds, and that you're going to meet the cost share, and particularly the community notification is a strong component that needs to be covered as part of the threshold criteria. Next slide, please. applicant eligibility, the first criteria that we're going to cover here, in general, it has to be a general purpose unit of local government, and we define that as we do it under our grant regulations, and that can include a variety of instrumentalities of local government. We include states and tribes on our list, quasi-governmental entities such as regional councils, redevelopment authorities, economic redevelopment agencies that are basically under the authority of a local government, and then 501c3 nonprofits are eligible for grant cleanup applications. Next slide, please. We do allow coalitions for assessments, and this is something new this year, and also for the revolving loan fund. They have to be separately qualifying legal entities, and included in the proposal is the documentation that that they are eligible and that there are letters that they agree to be part of the coalition. Again, you'll have to read, if you're going to do one of these coalitions, which are, they have slightly higher amounts, but by the time you divide it up, these are really designed for situations where you might have one of the members doesn't want to be burdened with the administrative duties of the grant and another entity would, and so they can combine their efforts. Next. The letter from the state or tribal environmental authority, this is a critical element. We have to get that in and give your environmental authority time. When we talk about environmental authority, I want to make it perfectly clear here. We are talking about the agencies in charge of the state environmental programs. That's the Iowa Department of Health and Environment, the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, Kansas Department of Health and Environment, and the Nebraska Department of Environmental Quality. Those are the entities that you go to. Petroleum determination is an additional letter, which we will be covering a little bit later, and so it has to be a current letter, it has to be from one of those agencies I mentioned, and it has to be included. Next. If you are applying for multiple types of grants, you can have one letter identifying each of those multiple types that the state is supporting you on, but you have to provide it as an attachment to each proposal. So get your copy machine out and do that. And also provide your state or tribal environmental authority sufficient notice to put out the letter. I've never seen a situation where a state refuses a letter, but they need time to crank the letter out so that you can have a timely application. Next. Brownfield site eligibility is the next element, a point back on that threshold criteria that must pass. The universe of site eligibility is broken into two major divisions. One is the hazardous substance sites. The other is petroleum sites. Hazardous substance would be anything that is non-petroleum, or if it is petroleum mixed in with the hazardous substances, it counts as a hazardous substance site. EPA will be the decision maker whether or not the site is eligible. On petroleum sites, if it's predominantly petroleum at the site, not mixed, then that is how you would classify the site. In other words, incidental hazardous substances cleanup would not be a problem. The state will be the decision maker, except in the situation where it is for a tribal application, and the state will be issuing a separate petroleum eligibility letter, which we'll be covering in just a few slides. Next, please. Is again, the non-tribal petroleum site applicants provide answers to the petroleum threshold questions, give that to the state contact in sufficient time for them to make an eligibility determination. This is not just the easy state acknowledgement letter that we're talking about, but this requires the state to have a body of information to make an actual determination based upon specific criteria whether or not the site is eligible. And those criteria are that it has to be a low-risk site. There is no viable responsible party. The applicant is not a responsible party, and there is no Resource Conservation Recovery Act corrective action under for petroleum types of cleanup. Now, I will refer you at this point in to your booklets and the description of petroleum sites eligibility is going to be in section 2.3.2 in the cleanup grant guidance, and it'll be as an appendix for all of the others. I will tell you that for the site eligibility, again, these are specific to cleanups or site-specific assessment grants, but I will forewarn you that if you go for a community-wide assessment grant or RLF, you're going to have to be meeting these criteria, only it won't be in this application, it will be after your award. Next slide, please. Site eligibility, again, this is a repeat of the slide that Brad presented. It has to be a brownfield site, and this can include hazardous substances, contaminants, petroleum. We also include mine-scarred land and controlled substance sites. Those are going to be lumped generally into the hazardous substances application or category for application. Next slide. Certain sites are never going to be eligible, even though they are real property. Potentially, the development is at risk because of contamination. And this relates to basically the federal government's role in the Superfund cleanup program. If it's proposed or listed on the national priorities list of cleanup sites, in other words, the high-risk sites, if it's the subject of a planned or ongoing CERCLA short-term removal action, if it's subject to any orders under the Superfund law, or if it's property that is basically owned by the federal government. Next. There are certain other sites that are, even though they are potentially contaminated and they are real estate, that they are going to require a property-specific determination in order to be deemed eligible. And this would be property that's basically under court orders, administrative orders, and the like, under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act or other non-Superfund statutes, and certain petroleum sites that have already had some cleanup work under the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Trust Fund. It'll be determined eligible by a specific determination by EPA, and we're going to include certain criteria based upon protection of human health and the environment, economic development, use of the property for parks, greenways, similar recreational or non-profit purposes, a golf course. Next. Property ownership eligibility. This is another, I call them hurdles, but, you know, I think most of your properties are going to get in. We just need to prove this so that we can make the property eligible. This is a statutory component. I call it the general prohibition, and it's meant to keep the polluter pays enforcement concept separate from the brownfields assistance program. The bottom line here is that Superfund creates pretty broad liability provisions, including ownership of property. However, ownership is a requirement for cleanup grants by that June 30th of 2009 date that Brad covered. And therefore, that bottom bullet, it is necessary on a cleanup grant, or if it's a site assessment grant, that the applicant, well, for a cleanup grant, you don't have to own it, but you have to own the property under one of the exemptions, the Superfund. And this is the one thing that I wish you would call the contact for the Brownfields program listed in the booklet, so that if you have a question, you can talk to them. They can bring me on the line and we can discuss this matter to determine how we can get your property eligible, or if it's not going to work, how maybe we can either do a workaround if possible. Okay, next. The exceptions to Superfund liability are dependent upon how and when you acquired the property, and so that translates to the potential funding. Depends on how and when the site was acquired. Next. For cleanup grants, site ownership, as Brad had indicated, there has to be fee simple title by June 30th of 2009. Fee simple is a term in real estate law, meaning that you own the property to the exclusion of all others and that you can warrant title to it. You do not have to own the property at the time of application, and that is under the Brownfields grants program. We recognize there is a redevelopment cycle so that the community first identifies the property, they go in for an assessment grant, they get an assessment done which allows them to buy the property and do a cleanup grant, and then you get the partnership, the leveraging of resources, and then there's the community benefit for a productive property. On the fee simple title, a quick claim deed is not going to, standing alone, is not going to cut the mustard on it because that's not fee simple title. That just means that one person doesn't have any claim on the property. But discuss it with me so that we can determine whether or not it is the equivalent of fee simple title, or maybe we can get an attorney's opinion from your municipal council. Next slide, please. The most common acquisition scenarios for grantees, and we're talking about basically cities and towns, are tax foreclosure, eminent domain, or the purchase or donation of property. Many people think that because a property is donated, and they don't have liability under Superfund. That's not true. Purchase and donation are the same difference. However, you can meet these CERCLA defenses because there are specific defenses for tax foreclosure and eminent domain acquisition. There's an innocent landowner defense, the contiguous property owner defense, but the thing that we really want to focus on is the bona fide prospective purchaser exemption to Superfund liability, and it is, as I call it, the gold standard under the Brownfield law. Next slide, please. The BFPP, that's the acronym that we use, has two threshold criteria before you acquire the property, and then there are some continuing obligations after you get the property. You are going to have to keep this in mind if you're applying for a cleanup grant, if you're acquiring the property currently based upon some assessment work that you've done, or if you're going to be acquiring it sometime in 2009 before this deadline date. The principal guidance document is the Common Elements Guidance, and I believe that is available. Is that going to be? It's available at the EPA website, I know. It is only for acquisitions after January 11, 2002, but for grant purposes, we will go back in time, and if it was an earlier acquisition but you met all the criteria, you'll still be eligible for funding. Next slide. The two threshold criteria are that the person did not cause the contamination, is not affiliated with anybody that caused the contamination. Affiliated has a specific meaning. It could mean relatives, subordinate companies, and parents and captives and stuff like that, those types of relationships. It also means that the contamination all occurred prior to the acquisition. And then the second bullet is probably the most important thing. All appropriate inquiry has to be conducted prior to acquisition. All appropriate inquiry is a legal term of art that we're going to go into next, so let's go to the next slide. All appropriate inquiry is basically it's the phase one environmental assessment. It depends upon the date of acquisition, what standard was used, because that was an evolving and developing standard as a result of the Brownfields law. If the acquisition was before 1997, we can still have all appropriate inquiry, but it is very case-specific and relies on a variety of factors that I'm not going to go into now. A phase one is something that you should be fairly familiar with, but certainly your brownfields coordinator can let you know what that is. It is a commercially available standard, and an environmental professional has to render that particular assessment or conduct that all appropriate inquiry. Next. For ownership eligibility for this to apply for a cleanup or other grant, there has to be an all appropriate inquiry phase one, as I indicated. It has a shelf life, or it has to be current or updated. And for the cleanup property, if you have the property and you're applying for the cleanup grant, you have to have a phase two site assessment report, either a draft or a final, prior to the proposal. That is something that is above and beyond just the liability protections under Superfund, but that makes your grant more successful, a greater chance of success, because it will go closer to identify the particular type of contamination on the property rather than just sort of a wider net that the phase one does. Next slide. This is for the revolving loan fund grants. This is another of the threshold criteria. You have to describe the jurisdiction that you're operating under. I think this will generally be pretty easy to do, but you have to provide the answer, answer all the questions. Next. And for cleanups and for revolving loan funds, you have to show how you're going to get onto the property, what you're going to do for the cleanup oversight, because it has to be a bona fide cleanup. It's not just a bunch of laborers out there with shovels, although they will be part of the plan quite frequently. It has to be enrolled probably, well, it doesn't have to, but we highly, highly recommend that it's enrolled in a state voluntary response program. We don't have the state people right here, but they have great programs. That voluntary response program is something you ought to circle and underline, because not only do you get the grant money from EPA and you meet the requirements by enrolling in the voluntary cleanup program, but that voluntary response program goes by a variety of names in the state agencies. They will give you a clean letter after you've done the cleanup, and that's invaluable for the further development of the property. Legal opinion for the revolving loan fund, basically that they have the authority to manage a revolving loan fund, hold funds, make loans, and stuff like that. For an RLF coalition applicant, the lead party in that coalition, they have to be able to take actions regarding loan administration and cleanup within the jurisdictional boundaries of its members, if warranted. In other words, they have to have authority to operate over the entire area that the coalition operates. Next. And the last threshold criteria, community notification. This is very important. We'll let you know that for cleanup applicants, you have to provide the community with notice of your intent to apply for this particular year's grant, give an opportunity to comment, actually hold a meeting, and when you get comments, have those responses part of your application. If you're submitting more than one proposal, you can roll it up into a single meeting, but you have to, of course, attach all the information for each proposal. All targeted communities have to receive the notification and be provided an opportunity to comment on each proposal relevant to their community. So if you're working in different parts of town, you got to have access for those different parts. Next. An advertisement or some sort of equivalent notification, and it's provided, we provide examples in the guidance or in the frequently asked questions. I also highly recommend you look at that. If you have a particular question, has to be done at least 2 weeks by October 31st, 2008. prior to the submittal of the application on November 14th. It has to communicate that it's available for review, you'll take comments, public meeting, and page 19 on the cleanup grant guidance will give you further information on the proposal attachment. Next slide. I think we're done now. So at this point, I will hand the speakerphone over to Jim Steinberg.
The threshold, or not the threshold, the ranking criteria to explain those criteria. So I'm going to shut up and turn the phone over to them.
Thank you, Bob. Jim and I will be tag teaming the discussion, the ranking criteria. I'll be generally covering the assessment items, and Jim will be discussing the revolving loan fund and the cleanup items. Next slide, please. Proposals that pass the threshold criteria proceed to ranking. And this ranking is done by regions other than the region in which you submit your proposal. Ranking criteria are, in this presentation, are cross-referenced with the guidelines for your use so that you can refer back to specific sections of the guidelines when you prepare your proposals. In the 09 proposal guidelines, the ranking criteria have been consolidated into four major ranking criteria. The first one is community needs. The second is project description and feasibility of success. The third is community engagement and partnerships. And the fourth is project benefits. If you've prepared brownfield proposals in the past, you'll most likely recognize much of the content under these four ranking criteria and in the sub-criteria. For the purposes of this presentation, we'll cover everything, but we'll try to highlight what's new.
Amy, I'm just going to do a sound check just for quality. You can hear it still, correct? Huh? Can anybody hear us? I mean, I just don't want to be talking into a black hole.
You can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you. It should be remembered that these grants are made in support of EPA's strategic plan. Thus, it is important when presenting your application to tie all the pieces together coherently in support of the assessment or cleanup to provide a healthy ecosystem and improve the community. In the ranking criteria, one should tie your strategic plan theme throughout the answers, address the question, give examples, and how it will all fit into the process of successfully running a grant while addressing the strategic plan of meeting the health, welfare, environmental, and financial needs as it improves communities and ecosystems while cleaning up the environment. More simply, it is important to hit all four of the needs listed, health, welfare, environmental, and financial, then relate how these four needs will be addressed by the Brownfields grant. Regardless of the aspects, don't talk at it. Expand on the need and why it will be addressed by this grant. Remember, describe is more than list. It means go into detail. Next slide.
We're on slide number 55. You want to be sure to answer each criterion and sub-criterion individually. The points totals for all three of the grant types add up to 100. However, in order to make the points totals work out to be 100, points totals for the individual criteria are sometimes different amongst the assessment, RLF, and cleanup guidelines.
As stated before, remember, there are three different guidelines this year, which is different from the one before, one each for assessment, cleanup, and RLF. Don't assume that the answers track across the criteria or the sub-criteria or between the grant guidelines. Make sure you use each set of guidelines to prepare your answers. It is very important to strictly follow the guidelines and make your presentation stand out from the rest. Remember, the proposal guidelines state proposals must substantially comply with the proposed submission instructions and requirements set out in Section 4 of this announcement, or they will be rejected. On that note, I would like to point out that page counts will be strictly enforced. Next slide.
The first ranking criteria we plan to discuss is community needs. Next slide, which would be number 57. In community need, proposals will be evaluated on the basis of the applicant's description of its health, welfare, environmental, and financial needs of the targeted community as it is affected by brownfield sites. Responses need to clearly identify the sources of all information cited in this section. On to the next slide, number 58.
This is where we go into health, welfare, and environment. We look at the targeted community and also the sensitive populations. Although it has already been stated, go into detail on how the brownfield impacts your community. Make sure to talk about the contamination and expand on what it is and how it impacts the community and sensitive populations. Provide information or data of how the targeted community is disproportionately impacted by the environmental problem. Also detail the impacts on the health and welfare. Make sure to provide information on sensitive populations and how the brownfields impact them. And remember the urgent deal right here at the bottom, which says identify all information sources. Ensure rest or proposal relates to this targeted community.
We can move on to the next slide, number 59. Subcriteria B under community need asks for the applicant to describe the economic impacts of brownfields in their targeted community. Use all the information that you can to make your case and to tell your story. Use poverty rates for your area, local, state, federal. Make that comparison. Use unemployment data and any other data that you think are relevant to explain why your community has financial needs. Discuss the impact of closed factories and other economic downturns that affect your community. In this day, I sort of expect this year that we'll see some applications, at least nationally, that talk about residential property foreclosures and the effect of them on targeted community. Ultimately, explain why, but for EPA grant funding, this project would not happen.
How will the assessment or clean up impact the community, and what financial impact will be derived from this improvement in the environment as a result of the assessment and cleanup? Make sure to detail the financial impact on the community. And in addition, present the limitations of the community to get other sources of funding if applicable. If you'll notice, there's another urgent here that says identify all information sources that you'll remember from the last screen. Next slide, 60, please.
The second ranking criteria we need to talk about is project description and feasibility of success. We can move on to the next slide, number 61. Under this criterion, applicants are being asked to explain why your project has a high likelihood of success and thereby deserves to be funded, especially when we stated earlier in Brad's presentation that only about a third of the proposals nationally received last year got funded. So be sure to highlight your project and make it rise to the top. Explain your approach. Explain why you have significant resources to complete the project and your capability to complete the project in a reasonable amount of time. Proposals that budget the majority of their funding for assessment fare better in the ranking process than those that focus on inventorying the sites and planning activities. Just as a reminder for assessment coalitions, remember that a minimum of 5 sites must be addressed under those types of grants. If you have questions about costs, what are allowable costs under this grant and what are not, be sure to refer to Section 6E, the Brownfield Programmatic Requirements.
This area evaluates the feasibility of the program and ability of the grantee to apply sufficient resources and capability to implement. Demonstrate the staff and commitment in time and resources. Next slide, slide 62, please.
Applicants just need to be sure to describe their project in significant detail so that an independent reader understands what your story is.
I want to emphasize the need for a complete definition of the cleanup plan. What types of controls are planned? How will you implement the controls? How will it be monitored? How will the future controls be guaranteed to remain in place? Also keep in mind, site reuse is important and should be addressed. Next slide, slide 53. This is a description for RLF only, and basically what we're talking about here is your brownfields development program and how the requested RLF grant funding will be used to support the program, its sustainability, the borrowers and subgrantees, the marketing plan, etc. Because there will probably only be around 11 RLF grants made, the competition is going to be hard. So it's very important to follow the guidelines to the nth degree and make your proposal stand out from the rest. Reviewers are going to be looking for viable, ready-to-make loans type grant proposals. Since the RLF grant is for only 5 years, the reviewers are watching for those applications that will expend funds and close out the grant within that period. It is imperative that you come across as ready to make loan candidate. As an RLF applicant, indicate how the loan administration program will be administered, detailing the commitment of time and resources. Also detail how the program will be organized and implemented. Next slide, slide 64, please.
This brings us to the budget. We recommend that applicants use the example format that's in the guidelines for each of the types of grants. That's not to say that you can't do something else, but what we've seen in the national ranking panels is that that usually doesn't bode well for the applicant. Be sure to explain your costs well in the narrative and give as many quantitative outputs as you possibly can. For example, when you're discussing in an assessment proposal the numbers of phase one and two assessments you plan to complete, be sure to try to give as many numbers as possible, that you're going to do 20 phase ones and 5 phase twos or whatever a reasonable number is for your community. Be careful to only list the eligible costs. Ineligible costs will reflect poorly on the applicant during the ranking panel. Always use the word programmatic. Never use the word administrative, because administrative costs are not allowable under the Brownfields law. And just a word here, this seems to trip people up, even in the work plans that I'm getting for the FY08 grants. Remember, equipment costs are purchases that are less than $5,000. Even if it sounds like equipment, like computers or software, if it's less than $5,000, it belongs under the supplies category.
Reviewers are looking for well-thought-out budgets, presented correctly with readily apparent grant management ability. This area is where the reviewers find if there is an understanding of the funds, et cetera, which will give them an idea if the grant writer will be able to implement the financial part of the grant and manage it correctly. I want to reemphasize to make sure you go into detail as to what each budget category is being used for. Also, as Stephanie said, avoid ineligible uses of funds. Having ineligible funds is probably one of the fastest ways to turn off a reviewer. If your grant is using health monitoring, institutional controls, etc., make sure that these are detailed in the budget as well. Next slide, slide 65.
This is the sample format for the assessment budget that I mentioned. If the numbers don't add up across and down, it reflects poorly on the applicant during the ranking. Fairly or unfairly, mistakes are viewed as indicative of your inability to prepare a coherent budget and work plan. Just a note, Region 7 thought the guidelines were a little bit ambiguous on whether applicants should do separate budgets for hazardous substances and petroleum when they're together in a community-wide proposal for a total of $400,000. We suggest that the applicants separate the budgets for hazardous substances from the budget for petroleum in an area-wide, a community-wide proposal for assessment, because these numbers can always be added together, but if we need to separate them for accounting purposes, it would be difficult. So just do separate budgets, please. And on to the next slide, number 66.
Slide 66 is to show that the cleanups, as well as RLF's next, require 20% cost shares. Make sure to detail cost share. This is where you confirm that you have an understanding of what a cost share is and how it works. Once again, make sure you know what is eligible for cost share. Remembering that 20% must be shown in the budget for either the cleanup or the RLF. Also, if you are using it for health monitoring, institutional controls, etc., also make sure this is detailed in the budget as well. Next slide, slide 67. Once again, this shows the RLFs need the 20% cost share and needs to be detailed in the budget. Remember that there are separate budgets for petroleum and for hazardous waste. And this is to make sure that you identify the fact that there have to be those two separate budgets. Next slide, slide 68, please. This slide is to show the need for having a separate sub-grant budget in the proposal. This should be one for each of petroleum and hazardous waste if you plan to sub-grant for both. Remember the 40% limitation for sub-grants. Finally, it is strongly stated that while you may deviate from the suggested budget format, you will do so at your own risk. What I have witnessed is that those who deviate make more mistakes and omissions. Thus, they get graded down because of them, with comments by the reviewers as to why didn't they follow the format. Also remember, these need to add up. They need to add across and down. Next slide, slide 69.
Okay, on this slide, we're not going to do this. This should have been hidden. This year we're using the same presentation for both the clue-in session and the face-to-face workshop, and so you get to see that this is what we'll do in the face-to-face workshop, which there's one tomorrow in Omaha and one here at our offices on Monday. So accidentally this got in here. Moving on to slide number 70. Under the leveraging criteria, sub-criteria, applicants are being asked to show how they will fund the project beyond the EPA funding and get it to completion. Where will the cleanup funding come from? You need to be sure to at least have some conceptual ideas about that. Where will you get the resources for taking the site all the way to reuse? Better projects at least give some conceptual information to address how to get the site from assessment to completion.
Leveraging should include the additional funding sources as well as additional resources that will be brought to the project. Next slide, slide 71.
Under programmatic capability, the regions review their own applicants. This is the only ranking criteria where regions review their own. In this sub-criteria, EPA is asking applicants to demonstrate that they have sufficient resources and capability to complete the project successfully. If you've been a past grantee, past brownfield grantee, you will answer little I, one. Answer this sub-criteria by describing how you've spent your money so far, how much money you have left, and what your plan to spend the rest of your money, and whether or not you've been in compliance with things like your terms and conditions of your grant, including your quarterly reporting. If you've had any quarterly reporting issues or adverse audit findings, just be truthful. Explain what happened and tell the reviewers what corrective actions you've taken to solve the problem.
This is not a time to bluff, but instead be straightforward. It is important to follow the instructions. If you've not had a government grant, don't try to be more than you are. Remember, you get 10 points if you just state you don't have any grants. If you go ahead and give information, you risk going below the 10 points. Detail your successes as well as come clean on those things that didn't necessarily go as well. Should there be some not-so-good circumstances, detail things that have been put in place to remedy these situations. Explain fully the staff and resources that you're committing to the success of this grant. Next slide, slide 72.
If you've not been a previous EPA grantee, you'll answer little I, too. Respond with examples from the 5 most recent federal or non-federal assistance agreements you've managed. Describe your ability to manage the grants in terms of your internal staff expertise and the systems and processes that you have in place so that you can demonstrate financial accountability to track EPA grant funding. If you lack environmental expertise, explain how you'll contract out for it. On to slide number 73. Community engagement and partnership is the third criterion. On to slide number 74. Under this criterion, applicants will be evaluated on the basis of their plan for engaging the targeted community. The extent to which the applicant has identified and established relationships in the targeted community, and the extent to which the support letters provided in this proposal from community-based organizations are involved in the project in a meaningful way.
Remember, letters are being used this year. It is important to relate how these organizations play into your plans. How are you engaging the community? And very important, is very important to the reviewers. It is important to include community organizations, and remember that they do not include local government departments, the local planning department, local contractors, the mayor, etc. Show past successes with involvement and how this will relate to the grant. Next slide, slide 25.
Subcriteria 3A asks you to describe your site selection process, how your community will be involved in cleanup and reuse planning, and also this subcriterion asks about past community involvement in the target area and how you'll report your progress back to your community. Don't forget to explain how you'll address any language or communication barriers in the community.
It is important to keep the community involved. Make sure you do so effectively and show how the methods you use will be effective. Remember to use languages commonly used in the community. If there are no issues, state why there are no issues and why this will not be needed. However, you should always state that this, you're ready to accommodate any that should arise. It is important to do more than just talk about it. One needs to say what it is and how it will be implemented and who will benefit. Next slide, slide 76. Make your partnership with the local, state, tribal environmental health agencies more than one of just listing them. Show that you have a grasp of what they do and how they are made up. State how you will be incorporating these resources into your project. Explain what these agencies will bring to the table and provide for any gaps that they may have in complying with EPA cleanups. For example, should the BCP not include anything for asbestos cleanups or lead, state this and then indicate how this gap would be handled.
Don't forget to include your local health department, if applicable. And if you plan to do health monitoring, you should also briefly discuss it here on to slide number 77.
Provide a description of the community-based organizations. Also do remember the support letter for each organization, the grassroots organizations that would be included. And also remember, support letters from reference organizations are required this year. Remember to be expansive on these organizations and their role in the project. Don't just list. Show the interrelationships that are involved. Also show that these organizations, what these organizations bring to the table. Once again, remember those letters. Describe the results and how these results will benefit the targeted groups in the community. For example, if you're including health monitoring, have state did health issues, make sure to tie how what you have planned will address those issues.
Just remember that the guidelines specifically state that these letters of support need to be non-governmental. On to slide number 78. 78 is, again, a slide that should have been hidden. That'll get covered in the faith-based workshop. On slide 79, this brings us to criterion 4, project benefits. On to slide number 80. In this criterion, applicants are being asked to describe how the project promotes the general welfare, health and safety, economic and environmental benefits to the targeted community. Explain how the project promotes the overall community vision. And consideration in the ranking panels will undoubtedly be given to projects that address threats to public health and incorporate sustainable practices into the cleanup and or the reuse of the site. On to slide number 81. The first sub-criterion, welfare and or public health, asks applicants to address how the project will result in environmental, social, and public health benefits to the targeted community. Explain why your community will benefit from a golf course, if that's what your reuse is. If you've highlighted sensitive populations in your response to the community need in criterion 1, you need to be sure to follow this up with a discussion of how the project will protect your sensitive populations or your however you've described your community in your response to criterion 1. On to slide number 82.
This asks you to describe direct and non-economic benefits. I always like to throw it in as the golf course screen because this is when you can add it for the green space and various things that you want to do. Don't just use buzzwords like reuse, sustainability, or green. Explain what you plan, how you plan to implement it, and the benefits that will be derived from the implementations. Non-economic benefits with the sites such as green space or other nonprofit activities must be detailed. Explain how the grant will produce economic benefits means more than stating that it will increase employment or expand the tax base. Explain how it will increase employment, how it will expand the tax base. Remember that describe is more than just listing. Next slide, please. Slide 83.
Okay. Project outcomes is the fourth criteria, sub-criterion. Just describe your plan for how you plan to track and measure your progress toward achieving your expected goals and outcomes. For example, be sure to discuss how you plan to report out on your number of sites assessed, the number of jobs created, and other funding leverage through the economic reuse of your site.
Could we go back to slide, or we're right here on 83. This slide relates, and since we kind of skipped it, I wanted to get back to it real quick. This slide relates to addressing infrastructure and its reuse and sustainability. So note how infrastructure will be used or not expanded. Try to incorporate as many of these as you can and how it will impact and improve the community. Remember, it is more important to maintain and reuse existing infrastructure rather than contributing to urban sprawl and expanding infrastructure. I believe we've done 84.
We did 84.
So,
and so at this point, we're going to turn over the presentation to Alma Moreno-Lom.
Thank you, Stephanie. Well, everyone, we're sort of, those of you that are skiers, you're at the top of that hill coming on down and being able to get your hot chocolate or your preferred drink, okay? So we are on the downhill slide here. So perk up. I want to make sure you don't miss these good proposal preparation tips. The way the ranking criteria in the new guidelines are organized really allows you a better way to tell the story this year. The ranking criteria are listed here on this slide, and I want to draw your attention to these. You start by presenting a compelling case by why you need to be funded. The key here is on need. For example, if you have people with challenged immune systems, such as children or the elderly, along with your poverty data and other data for your community, you don't want to forget these things. You want to make sure you highlight these. Other examples are lead levels, diabetes, cancer rates, and some of these are closely tied to certain ethnic groups, so you want to bear that in mind as you present your need. Then you want to tell the reader what you will do with the funding to address these needs. Again, it's the story with the common thread and making sure that you get back at addressing that need throughout this proposal. Convince the reader that you are ready to act and be successful in completing your project in a timely manner. Recall that slide 9 where you had the former Mariko plating example, and I believe Steph said that that was done in, what, 3 months, okay? When I first saw that slide, I thought, okay, we're talking about an FY08 proposal that is so uncharacteristic, okay? But that is what it is taking right now, projects that are ready to go and be completed, and money is not just sitting there for years waiting on waiting on activity.
It was all done as a pre-award cost.
Did you all hear that? It was all done as pre-award costs within those 90 days prior. So, remember that everyone wants to support a winner, okay? And
this is Bob Richards, and I'll just issue a disclaimer here. Pre-award cost is strictly at the discretion of the agency. We have some criteria, but don't just anticipate that you can go do a project and be paid for it next year.
Yeah. It is at risk. The pre-award costs are done at risk. But the key point here that I'm trying to make to you is we want projects that are ready to go. We want to see results. And those projects that indicate that are going to be the ones that are more, you know, provided you answer all your questions and provide good responses, those are the ones that are going to be more favorably looked at and more likely funded. For cleanup, for example, so basically you want to aim for firm commitment. For example, leveraging commitments. Maybe you need this to do the cleanup, but you have leveraging funding beyond that, or to provide for supplemental activities like demolition or things that are not covered by our funding. So for cleanup, for example, you want to think readiness. Number one, you want a fully characterized site, and number two, you want ownership. So I know that you don't necessarily want to take this unless you have the funding. So, for example, as I've mentioned in prior competitions, if you have an agreement in place with the current property owner that if you get funded, you will take ownership at set price before June 30th, 2009, a proposal that has that versus someone that doesn't have acquisition yet and just says we will get it before that, which one do you think, which one, if you were putting your money on, which one would you bet on? And that's the key here, because we do have, in cleanup in particular, there are a number in our region this year that did not get the property. So even though they were very successful in their proposal writing and they were selected, they were not able to get awarded because they did not meet that ownership deadline. The next item, number three, Brownfields is all about engaging people. It's really about involving individuals and groups. So you want to demonstrate who you will engage and how it is that you will engage them. And remember, this is engagement, not just telling them, but actually getting them involved. Remember, this should be tied to your need and to your target area. So, you know, if you're targeting a particular minority community and they're predominantly speak Spanish, you don't want to forget to address the language barrier. If you're dealing with a particular community where you know that they gather in churches, for example, you want to make sure that you work through the churches to get the word out on your project. Those are just some examples of the non-traditional ways that would work for a particular need in a particular target group or target area. Lastly, tell the reader the benefits to the target group and the area and filling the need. And you need to think human health and the environment. I know you don't forget about the economics. We always see that, but we need to look at your need, and typically that's tied to human health and the environment, so make sure that that gets addressed. Your story needs to tie together neatly. You need to draw in the reader to want to fund your project over someone else's. Remember, this is a very competitive process. So, for example, let's say that you have provided information about a very bad housing area and buildings that are abandoned and children have been caught there playing. They go through the fences and they play there, and there's been lead exposures, and there's problems like that. Then when you come and you tell me that for your green space, you're going to provide for a golf course instead of a community park, I think that should raise a red flag to you as a reader. Okay, and it will raise, I mean, not as a reader, but it will raise a red flag to the reader, and it's because it does not tie back to your needs. So make sure that you address that, and those are the projects that will likely get selected. Next slide, please. Be very careful this year because things have changed considerably from past years. You need to read the new guidelines. And, you know, it's gotten a little easier in the sense that if you're not coming in for an RLF, you're not reading that manual. If you're just coming in for assessment, you pull up that one manual and you focus on that. I would encourage you to circle your ands and your ifs or ors and make sure that you address every single question. Read the guidelines and follow. Please follow the directions closely. I cannot stress this enough. If you applied in the past years, remember to learn from the feedback that you received. Learn from your mistakes and improve on your proposal. Even though the guidelines have changed, a lot of the feedback that you got if you came in last year and even prior years would probably still apply, for example, specifics on budget, things like that. So please learn and make a difference in your proposal by learning from the feedback that you receive. Seek help from those that have been successful. They are usually willing to help if you give them advance notice. Be considerate of the fact that they may also be applying again this year, so don't wait until the last minute to get their help. Call them now. Answer every question, even if the answer is, quote, not applicable, unquote, with one exception, and that is programmatic capability, where if you have been a prior grantee, you answer one set of questions, and if you have not been, you answer another set of questions. Next slide, please. Slide 87 is where we're at. This year, we've included something in the new guidelines that should be very helpful to you, so please use the proposal checklist that is at the end of each of the ranking criteria sections in each of the three booklets. Remember to write as though the reader knows nothing about your community. You want to be able to paint your picture, create a, you know, tell your story, and have this be a very vivid depiction of what your community is. Remember, your reader could be someone that lives in New York City, where green space is very limited. He or she has no idea that green space in, let's say, Nebraska is abundant. So you need to let them know the specifics of your community so that they know, make them feel like they're there, okay? So you want your story to be easily read, and therefore you don't want to use acronyms or jargon or terms that you would be familiar with and others would not be. Since you are limited in space, remember that within the same proposal, you can reference the reader back to the information. Just do this sparingly because, again, you want your story to kind of be seamless and easily read. Next slide, please. Slide 88. Clearly and concisely address all threshold and ranking criteria, and in your response, you must, and this is a must, include the criteria number and title. This is something that is new, and Brad highlighted that earlier. You really need to do that. It's a requirement, not an option. Please be sure your entire story will be read by obeying the 18-page limit. The reviewers do not see what you mail in. They will see the 18 pages only. Well, your cover letter isn't included in that, but if you've got 20 pages, we don't get to see the last two, and therefore you get a lot of zeros on some of these portions. And remember, that's some pretty critical information that may not only help you in that question that is answered, but can also affect the scoring in other sections because all of these tie together. Use white space so that it's not so annoying to the reader in reading your story. And follow your margin limits and use the correct font. Do not use any binders. We won't get them all nicely bound. Color is pointless because reviewers get a black and white copy of your proposal to review. Photos and graphics will not be included for our review, so don't use them. It's just wasted effort, and you're losing part of your story when it's taken out. I know data presents well in table format, and if it's included within the text, it will likely be left in, but we cannot confirm that with certainty. That's what we believe will happen. Next slide, please. Slide 89. These are critical key points to help you succeed. You can draw the reader's attention with bolding, underlining, and italics. Just don't overdo it, or it loses its effectiveness. You might want to use that, for example, on your key needs. You have a checklist in the guidelines to help avoid missing or having any missing items or adding attachments that aren't part of what's required or allowable. So use that to prepare your package before mailing it. And make sure that you double check your letters when you receive them from the state or from your partners. Make sure that they have current dates. Please do not make mistakes, and if you find them, by checking on these things early, you can get them corrected. The key here is sometimes for the states, people wait until the last minute to request their letters, and they're dealing with a number of letters that are having to be cranked out at the last minute, and that's how they make the mistakes. Then you get it barely in time to mail it, and it's too late to get a new letter because you didn't plan early enough. So truthfully, prior preparation is the key here. Missing pages will be very costly to you. It leads to an incomplete story, which leads to an unconvincing case for funding. So also, you don't create confidence in your ability to actually run a project. So please check that you have all your pages before you mail your package. Next slide, please. Slide 90. Please, I can't stress this enough, call us now with your eligibility questions. This is something that we can talk to you forever and ever on, except you want to have it in time for preparing your proposal. So we can talk to you about it now. Don't waste your time writing a proposal for an ineligible site.
and to speak to Bob Richards, what you need to do is contact the Brownsville coordinator listed in the guidelines in Appendix 1 for Region 7, that is Susan Klein. And then she, in turn, will engage, will get Bob Richards included, and we will schedule a call with you. So please do that now. Again, the one and only question that is a stupid question is the one that is not asked. Be kind to the state and ask for your petroleum determinations now. Remember that you have to answer all of the threshold questions, even if it is to indicate that it is, quote, not applicable, unquote. As for others, ask for others' help right now also. Remember, they might be applying themselves, so be respectful of their time. And please do not forget, or I should say remember your state partners, because they can be a tremendous help to you in reviewing your proposals. We in Region 7 at EPA cannot do one-on-one coaching and reviewing your actual proposals, but the state partners can, and we work very closely with the state partners so that they are very aware, much like we are, of what ranks high and what doesn't. So you want to turn to them, and you want to start that process early, because you need to allow time for the state partners to work those reviewing your proposals into their regular workload, and allow them time to prepare meaningful comments for you and discuss those with you, and then you need time to be able to make a change in your proposal. So you cannot wait on this at the last minute. You can imagine if there's 20 applicants from Missouri, if they all wait until the last minute. So that's not going to allow for meaningful input. For cleanups only, set up your public meeting and engage people before you submit your proposal. I want to refer you to the guidelines on page 19 of the cleanup guidelines, if you have those in front of you. And there is a key piece that says here, in addition, the applicant must provide a summary of the comments and its response to those comments to EPA for the agency to consider prior to awarding the grant. So you need to do this early. It's got to be done before your proposal is submitted. You must have this public meeting. And also think back of that slide 25 where you had the pickup with the propped up sign. You do what works for your community. Next slide, please. Slide 91. Well, let me help you by providing you the key contacts, which brings us to slide 92. And here are everyone's names, titles, and contact information. Moving on to slide 93. I'm sorry, slide 93. These are the key state contacts. I can't stress this enough. You really need to call them now. If for nothing else, even if you don't want them to review your proposal, remember there's a piece where you need to establish that you have a working relationship with your state. Most of these, in order to do cleanup, for example, and even on assessments, you've got to work with the state. And if you have never talked to them, if you're a new applicant, for example, then you need to establish that relationship now. And you need to be able to say that you've worked with them or are working with them or have an agreement with them, not that you are going to. Okay? So please, use these numbers and use them now. Next slide, please. We are at slide 94. And there are a number of resources here. I know that with so much to do in your regular work, you know, the last thing you need is a whole bunch of reading. But you do need to read the guidelines. That's the first website there. And I would highly, highly recommend that you read your frequently asked questions. In particular, I would recommend it even for experienced applicants, but most definitely for a new applicant, because those frequently asked questions will save you worrying and questioning and trying to reread and re-understand. By just going and reading those, you will learn so much. And then if you still have questions, please, you can call. Again, what we can discuss mostly is the eligibility. For those of you that are going to work on coalitions, there's that last website is very important to you. There's a sample document there. And remember, your coalition memorandum of agreement do not have to be in place before your proposal is submitted. That has to be in place before award. But your letters from your coalition members, which is one of the items on the checklist, must be included in your proposal. That is that you're going to be the lead for this grant on their behalf and that they are a coalition member and that they've given that authority to you. Next slide, please. A couple more websites for resources for you. And with that, we will now go to Amy with SRA, who will handle questions.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for the presentation. We'd like to take the question and answer section. We've received one question online, and I'll just read that question off to EPA Region 7, and Brad, maybe you can delegate the best person to answer. The first question, does an eligible entity need to also own the property to be eligible for an assessment application?
No. you have to have show that you have access to the property, that you're going to be able to get access to it, but no, you do not own the property, and that goes down to that development cycle where you identify the property, community need, you do an assessment grant, and then you use that assessment, that all appropriate inquiry product, to then purchase the property as a BFPP, and then you're eligible for the cleanup grant. Then you partner with the developer and do the leveraging, and then you have your redevelopment. So that's a very long answer, but it is not designed to require you to own the property for an assessment grant.
Okay, great. We have about 10 more minutes, and I'd like to open up the floor for additional questions.
Amy?
Yep.
Brad Van Heerden, EPA. I'd like to make 2 points of clarification from my earlier slides, since these are new. One of the points I wanted to clarify, and one of my coworkers pointed out, when you come in for an assessment coalition, your maximum allowable fund is $1 million. That can be for hazardous substance and or petroleum. And the split, the examples I gave was where I had $500,000 and $500,000 dedicated to each, a maximum of $1 million. That split can be completely different. It doesn't have to be maximum $500,000, maximum $500,000. That was the maximum because that was the example provided. So I just want to provide that clarification. The other note to make is that if you come in for a hardship waiver for under cleanup or what have you, be sure that you have some sort of a backup plan because you might get selected, but you might not get the waiver. So you want to make sure that your project is set up to be successful in the event that your, say, 20% cost match was not allowed or not waived.
Thanks, Brad.
And this is Bob Richards. I don't know whether I'm just flogging a dead horse or repeating something that's already been said, but if you go to the EPA Brownfields website where you apply for funding, it'll come up with all of these, the three booklets for the types of grants that we've been talking about, but also it'll have the frequently asked questions, and that is a very good resource to describe how to put together a good application and to also it provides clarification, sources of information, and so forth. So I highly recommend that document to you.
Great, thanks. I have another question online. Can a nonprofit be a member of a coalition as long as it is not the applicant?
Let's see, coalitions are for assessment and for revolving loan fund, and a not-for-profit cannot be a part of that coalition.
They're not an eligible applicant.
Because they're not an eligible applicant. Yeah.
For RLF or
assessment. RLF or assessment. But this was, I think the question was directed to cleanup grant, wasn't it?
I thought it was assessment or RLF, and then on an assessment, the nonprofit
cannot apply.
And under an RLF, they cannot either.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Are there any other questions from anyone else on the line?
Amy, it's Alma, and I just want to point out to folks that if you attend the full-day session for the training, these workshops that we're having that are full-day, there's another opportunity to ask questions that are not just the threshold questions, but all of these questions on ranking. So I would highly encourage folks to go to the session tomorrow in Omaha and then on Monday in Kansas City. It gives you time to digest what you just received and yet then have an avenue for addressing questions on ranking that you otherwise cannot do because we don't handle one-on-one questions on those. We can only handle them in a general outreach format like we are doing now.
Right, great. And in addition to those two in-person meetings, there's also a second clue-in session on Tuesday, October 21st from 9 to 11 a.m. And this section is going to focus on the specific changes to the FY09 Brownfields Proposal Guidelines. If you'd like to register for that as well, the presentation is going to be given similarly with slides and frequently asked questions and then followed by an open forum. So are there any additional questions? Okay, well, I'd just like to remind everyone to take a few minutes to fill out the evaluation form online. You can access this using the link provided in your confirmation email. And if you scroll down to the bottom of the web page, you can click on the seminar feedback form link. And we'd really appreciate any comments that you have in order to help improve these clue-in sessions. And feel free to contact any of the people listed in the presentation. All of their contact information was provided in the PowerPoint presentation. So if you have any questions, feel free to contact them. Any last-minute questions from anyone? Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for your participation.